Hi. Thanks for coming. Let's see. I am going to be talking about Zen and the arts. And so, to start out, I have a few handouts. just for some visuals. I know there's not enough to go around for everybody, but maybe if everyone can at least see one and share with your neighbors. So like I said, the topic is Zen and the arts, and it's actually, you know, an enormous topic, two enormous topics. So I'm not going to be able to cover very much, but I hope that this will be, I'm sort of approaching this as sort of the beginning of a conversation, and I hope to leave enough room at the end so we can have, so I can have some feedback from you and you can share your thoughts too. So, to begin, I just want to talk a little bit about my story and how I came to this. And I was always one of those kids who wanted to be an artist, and I started to draw as soon as I could pick up a pencil. And lucky for me, my mother was also an artist, so she taught me how to do these things at a very early age. And so this became a really important practice in my life, and I continued to do it, and I was lucky enough to have other people around me, other creative people, and that encouraged me and supported me. So I continued this on through middle school and high school, and it became a very stabilizing force in my life during the turmoil of my adolescent years and high school years. So it really became an important practice for me just beyond the activity itself. And but when I went off to college, I made an attempt to pursue a practical career in science. But by my junior year of college, I decided that what I really wanted to do was fine arts. So I switched my major and I graduated with a fine arts degree. And within a year of my graduation, the art market crashed. So I had very few prospects, and I ended up working in an independent bookstore. And again, a stroke of luck, I was surrounded by a lot of people who were just like me, who were artists and musicians and writers of every type. And so there was this great community of creative thinkers, and I started to just read a lot of things that I'd never had time for before. And I fell in love with poetry. And the first poet that I really fell in love with was Rilke. And so I started looking for other poets who had been influenced by him. And then that led to other poets who had been influenced by them, and so on. And pretty soon I found another pattern starting to appear, and it was that many of these poets were also making reference to Eastern thought, or Buddhism in particular. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting. You know, I wonder if this same thing happened in visual arts, but I just didn't learn about it. So I went back and started looking at the artists that I was inspired by, and I had to dig a little bit because this stuff really isn't in the official text. But if you seek out the writings by the artists themselves, it's there. There's a lot of reference, and sometimes very explicit references to Buddhism and other forms of Eastern thought. So about this time, too, a couple of my friends have started to meditate, and one of them told me about the intro class here. And so I came and I learned the practice, and I started to practice here. And it became pretty clear to me why a lot of artists are attracted to this, to Zen. Well, Buddhist practice in general and Zen practice in particular. And I also found that I discovered that Zen has a very special relationship with the arts that the other Buddhist practices. Well, it differs a little bit from the other Buddhist practices. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about that special relationship. And this is going to be, again, I'm going to skip over a lot of details. It's sort of like a, what was that? It's like this 10-minute Shakespeare, you know? It's like 1,000 years of history in a few minutes. But just want to hit some key points on the development of arts within Zen practice and then how that came to America. Art relating to the Buddha and the Dharma began to appear about 200 years after the Buddha's death. Initially, the Buddha had requested that he wanted no images of himself made. He didn't want it to be about him. He wanted it to be about the practice. But you know how we are. Human beings like things. But it took about a couple hundred years, and the first Buddhist art started to appear. And it was in the form of first architecture, and then paintings and sculptures. And these can be divided into three sort of major categories. The first was literal depictions of the Buddha. The second was documentations or illustrations of the sutras or the teachings. And the third was metaphorical representations of the journey to enlightenment or the enlightened state of mind itself. So as Buddhism traveled into different countries, the art took many different forms, and it was informed by the culture wherever it landed. So when Buddhism entered China, it encountered Taoism. And Taoism, as many of you know, has a great appreciation for nature and the arts. And so again, after a few hundred years of mixing, what was once this deeply metaphysical Indian philosophical tradition becomes transformed into the direct practical practice that we know of as Zen. And from the very beginning, Zen incorporated the arts into practice. But it took a while, and about the 10th century, a shift started to occur in what was acceptable subject matter. And I just want to read this quote out of this book, which many of us read for practice period, Zen and the Zen of Creativity, because Laurie really describes this pretty well here. He says, by the Sung Dynasty in China, which was 960 to 1279, Common Era, the Zen arts of painting and poetry reached their highest stage of development. With the emergence of a novel phenomena, painter priests and poet priests, who produced art that broke with all forms of religious and secular art. This art was not representational or iconographic. It did not inspire faith or facilitate liturgy or contemplation. It did not function to deepen the devotee's experience of religion. It was not used in worship ceremonies or as part of prayer. Its only purpose was to point to the nature of reality. It suggested a new way of seeing and a new way of being that cut to the core of what it meant to be human and fully alive. Zen art as sacred art touched artists and audiences deeply, expressed the ineffable, and helped to transform the way we see ourselves in the world. So one of the first examples of this is the picture of the first picture here is Muchi's persimmons. And this is from the 13th century, and Muchi is sort of considered the Leonardo da Vinci or whatever, you know. He's highly regarded as one of the first to shift to create this type of Zen art. And then when Zen moved to from China to Japan, it took with it this emphasis on the arts and actually further interwove it into Zen training, to the extent that many monks, I don't know if all monks, but many of the monks were required to take on an art form as part of their training. So most of what we now think of as Zen art comes from Japan and can be traced back to the 6th century tea master and Zen monk Sen no Rikyo. It was he that took this Chinese aesthetic, well, the beginnings of this aesthetic and really developed it. And, you know, what he developed came in many forms. You know, it was the tea ceremony, it was haiku, no drama, ceramics, flower arranging, calligraphy. It really encompasses a broad range of creative activity. And shortly after Rikyo died, Japan closed its borders to the outside world, fearing that the outside world would corrupt its culture. So what happened was this aesthetic was able to develop unimpeded for 250 years. And so it not only became highly refined, but it became intimately linked with Zen and became part of the identity of Japanese culture as a whole. And what happens, and so this is leads me to the second illustration here. This painting on the second page is by Sengai. And this comes out of that period of isolation. So it was around 1800. Then, when the borders opened up in the mid-1800s, art from China and Japan began to filter into Europe. And almost immediately, you can start to see this influence in Western artists, including the early Impressionists and on up to Gauguin and Van Gogh. And these artists were mostly, firstly attracted to the forms of art, techniques and technical form of this type of artwork, and then through the forms they were led to the philosophy. What was happening in Europe at the time is significant because the rise of industrialization and the middle class and the merchant class had shifted the art market so that the patrons of the arts were no longer solely the church or the royalty. And so the subject matter in 18th century European art had already started to shift to everyday subject matters and everyday people and events. So there was kind of this coming together of like-mindedness. So it kind of hit at the right time. Also in the late 19th century and early 20th century, artists were in Europe were becoming increasingly disillusioned with the political and cultural structures of the time. After the First World War and increasingly after the Second World War, there's a sense that Western philosophy and structures had failed. They were pointless in stopping the devastation of the wars, and so the artists started to look elsewhere for inspiration, and they found Eastern art. And Dada, in particular, grasped onto Buddhism and Buddhist thought and created an art that was directly in opposition to the establishment in Europe at the time. Let's see, where am I now? Okay, yeah. Dada set out to create art that was anti-art, anti-craft, using common materials and intentionally making no statement of meaning. They also incorporated commercial printing techniques that were new and kind of went against the grain of what was established as appropriate art making. And they actually called themselves Western Buddhists. And I think for them, theirs was a more philosophical affiliation as far as I know, they were not practicing, but they really had an affinity for the philosophy. And then after World War II, when service people started coming back from Japan, and after having had direct experience with Japanese culture, it was about this time when some of the first Zen teachers started to come to America as well. And so you started to see the phenomena of artist practitioners emerge. And by the 50s, the artists began to see the Eastern influence as not only a philosophy, but as a practice similar and complementary to the artistic process. So just to read another quote here. Since throughout the 50s, the reasons for making art were reevaluated and the creative process analyzed. The notions of tradition and desire were redefined. No longer was art made as directed totally by Western traditions. No longer were the works of art to have a direct relationship with objects in the sense that they were substitutions for the appearance in the visible world. No narrative or didactic process was planned or implemented. No absolute meaning was determined. Instead, artists described their preparations and procedures as yogic or meditative, and trusted in chance and spontaneity. Many artists also made use of humor and paradox in the manner of the Zen slap, which the master would use to give to get the attention of the viewer. Artists saw their works as the Zen Buddhist direct pointing, as Suzuki and Watts had related on many occasions. When the Zen master points at the moon, the student is warned not to mistake the finger for the moon. And so this sounds to me a lot like that first quote. And so the artists are starting to really practice and incorporate these things into their life and into their practice. And so you can see a progression began to develop that's similar to what the progression that Buddhist art took. And it's one from representational image to abstraction to idea to experience. And Marcel Duchamp once said, it's not the thing that's art. Art is the gap. Art is what happens when one encounters the work. And so when we try to place a specific meaning on these works, we miss the point. The meaning doesn't reside in the work itself. It resides in the encounter with the work. So just to kind of recap here, I mean, some of the 20th century art movements that have been inspired, at least in part, by Buddhism and Eastern thought are Dada, Abstract Expressionism, Jasper Johnson, Robert Rauschenberg, and the Black Mountain School. Pop art, conceptual art, fluxus, performance art, and installation art. And it doesn't leave much out. You know. So I wanted to share this with you. I mean, and it continues, and it just kind of explodes in the 60s, and I won't get into that. But I just wanted to share this with you because I wanted to show that this form of artistic and aesthetic exploration of the Dharma is part of our cultural legacy. It's not something that we have to recreate, and it's not something that we have to go back to China and Japan for. Although, you know, those forms of art are very beautiful and inspiring, but it is part of our culture, and so it's interesting for me to look at ways that Western people have explored these ideas and how that relates to our lives and our practice. I also wanted to show you that one of the major ways that Buddhism came to the West is through the arts. And many people were like me, were brought to Buddhism through the arts. And so it's just another way that came here, and it's a significant way. So So the question is, what does this mean for us now in our practice? And I'm just going to, I just wrote down sort of a list of my thoughts, and I want to just read them to you and then open it up for discussion and have you guys comment and share your own experiences and whatnot. But so here's what I came up with. Art, like Zen, has no practical or functional purpose. Art is about paying attention. Zen is about paying attention. If Zen practice is about realizing who we are, art practice is about the expression of the experience of who we are and what it means to be human. The focused concentration that artists engage in often enables them to fall into a sort of altered state of consciousness akin to the dropping away of body and mind that can also happen in Zazen. The artist and the action become one. It's effortless effort. Art is the practice of failure. Nothing ever turns out the way you envision it in your mind, and therefore it is helpful in training ourselves to let go of fixed ideas of how we think things should be. Art is a present moment activity. Imagination, as opposed to fantasy, requires that we look at the materials at hand and see what we can make with them. Art can act as a bridge between our experience on the cushion and our daily lives. It's a way of playing with our experience and chewing on ideas in a way that it's not threatening to our lives and those around us. No one ever died from looking at a bad painting or from making one. At least not that I know of. Art is a way of practicing consciously creating our lives. One of my my artistic heroes, Joseph Beuys, once said famously that everyone is an artist. And by that he didn't mean that everyone should quit their day jobs and try to make a living as an artist, but it was a recognition that we're all creative beings just by our very nature, and that we create our lives and by extension our world with each moment and with each action. So when we engage in our, well, so the only choice really is whether we're creating consciously or unconsciously. And art is a way to train our minds to create consciously. And before I end, I just want to encourage everyone to just to try to engage in some sort of pointless art making. And I say pointless because you can engage creatively in any activity, but when it's pointless, you're less inclined to be attached to the outcome. And, you know, you can explore a lot more and play around. And you don't have to show anyone. but you will learn something about yourself. And also, I encourage you to take a fresh look at the work of other people, the artwork of other people, and try to engage wholeheartedly with that as a viewer or audience member and kind of let go of your preconceived notions and just engage as an experience. And that will teach you something about yourself, too. So, finally, I just want to read this quote by Norman Fisher, who, as many of you know, is a Zen teacher and a poet. And he says in writing about this topic, he says, we need art as a form of recreation, recreation of ourselves and of our world, a freshening of what goes on day by day in our ordinary living. Viktor Shlavsky, the Russian formalist critic, arguing for attention to formal detail in art, said, to make a stone stony, this is why there is art. Art defamiliarizes the familiar and thereby makes it new. Artists know this, but not only artists. We all sense that in looking at the world outside of our own personal interests and habits, we can feel something of the divine, of the whole. We can therefore approach our daily tasks with this heightened sense of things, taking care of our homes, our relationships, our communities, and ourselves with attentiveness and love. That is, as if we were artists grappling with our materials. And he also says, Zen has probably saved me from myself, and poetry has probably saved me from Zen. And I think we need to be saved from Zen from time to time. So that's a lot of information. And just to kind of go over what I gave you here, these are just a few examples of kind of 20th century art. And it doesn't by any means illustrate all the different movements. But what I found interesting is if you look at the history of at least 20th century art, you see this this sort of dance between the artists moving away from form and towards just pure abstraction and void. And then form starts to appear again. So it's kind of this dance between form and void and back again. And I found that really interesting. And then I thought it was kind of a nice symmetry to bookend the apple with the persimmons. It's the Yoko Ono piece called Sometimes an Apple is Just an Apple. And then on the back is another, it's one of Yoko Ono's instruction paintings. So it's really dematerialized or it may be made more material because many, many pieces can be created from this. And then the authorship is in question. But so I found those things interesting. And I also, you know, if anyone's more interested in the timeline of art history, I do have some resources that I can share with you. But I didn't want to drone on for hours. So I hope that you guys also have some things to share, because I know that many of you are also artists and creative people. So comments or poems or whatever.
I'm probably a representative of the larger people without art history. But this week
you
I
never know.
To do spring cleaning and to finally organize my apartment. And my original intention was to do it left, right, left, functional, orderly, everything lined up. And you've actually given me pause for thought.
Yeah, great.
As clumsy as it may be. And that's to make the apartment more
Yeah. Well, one of the things that happened, you know, a lot of these artists that were working in the 50s, not especially into the 60s, there was a conscious attempt to merge art and life, and to narrow the distinctions to basically no distinction. And so there you have it. Anyone else? Yeah.
Can you talk about how many of your dozen practices have influenced your own art?
Well, I think it's influenced my own art quite a bit, in that it has, in some of the ways I hit on it there, it has heightened my attention. To the world, and it has also, I think the two practices have worked together in helping me to recognize inspiration in all places, so that I maybe notice things that I didn't before, and those things then I'm more willing to use them as appropriate subject matter that maybe I would have dismissed before. And also as a practicing artist, I think that Zen practice has really enabled me to have more equanimity in relationship to my ego. Because art practice can be just this huge roller coaster of ego. Because the highs can be really high and the lows can be really low. Because you identify so much yourself with your work. And so that has helped me tremendously, just to keep going, because a piece happens, and then you're done and you move on and you start fresh again. And it's just another one comes and another one. And it helps me to, you know, let go of a little bit, you know, I'm not perfect by any means, but of the successes and the and what I would call failures. Although failure then becomes just part of the process. Sort of success, I guess.
Well, really, I have a very similar question. It might be the same question. But we had a conversation a while ago where you talked to me about, as an artist in training, learning how to see and learning how to look at something totally differently than you would have before you had this training. And I'm wondering if Zen practice has altered that, or enhanced that, or changed that, or made it harder, or ruined it, or anything.
Well, it's interesting because I really didn't have very much formal training. I really only had like 2 years of formal training. Most of my training was really from my mother, but it wasn't really training. It was just drawing. It was just doing. And so I think, at least in my my development, art practice was the practice of seeing, and it just looking and looking and looking. And I spent hours and hours and hours trying to, you know, draw things representationally. And so that process, actually, it's a mind-body connection of transferring what you see on more and more subtle levels to whatever piece of paper or whatever. And so I think what happened when I started to practice Zen is sort of, I think it enhanced, but it was also initially a recognition of a similar practice that I'd already been doing.
And here it is in another form.
And here it is in a way that supports this practice that I'd already been doing. Or maybe even just brought it to my awareness, because I didn't realize that it really was a practice. Uh-huh. It was just something that I'd always done. And I find that's true with a lot of artists that I know, is that they just sort of, you know, unconsciously, most of the time, develop this way of looking at the world. And if you walk around with other artists, they see things that you would never see, you know, or pay attention to. Like garbage, you know, cracks in the sidewalk, you know, rusted old pieces of metal, you know, things like that. Or, you know, like the pop artists started to introduce everyday objects, things that weren't traditionally considered appropriate subject matter, or things that we would even pay attention to in our lives. You know, the shifts of color on the trees, things like that. Am I even answering your question?
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm kind of going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Scott?
I acknowledge that I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so my children, the young, they get introduced to the working studio, and they could take materials. My son, when he was in high school, around Christmas, making Christmas gifts. We were each of them different and I looked over at him. And he had a block of wood in his left hand with some welding fire coming out of it. And he had a pair of pliers in his hand. And he was looking up, you know, staring at nothing, really. I said, Hans, what are you doing? And he says, I love not knowing where this is going.
Beautiful thing here is that it kind of characterizes the person you became. It kind of characterizes art making and your experience, not to mention life. Well, I think kids get this instinctively. I mean, I think most people have this experience when they're young, of this just experience of creating, and it's intimately linked with play. And we sort of are, I don't know, taught out of it or something. Something happens at a certain age that people start having that kind of fresh interaction with the world. But I just think that it's... I take issue with anyone who says they're not creative. I just think, you know, if you think that, just challenge yourself a little bit, because I just think it's part of our nature. I don't think that we can get away from it as human beings. So.
You mentioned Dougal Laurie.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he uses art as one of the gates to awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And so two questions. Would you like to see art used that way here? And then secondly, would you be one of the teachers?
Wonderful how you answer the first one.
Yes, I would like to see it. More of that. And I would love to be involved in it. But I just look around the room and I see many people who could also teach this. So I think it's part of our Sangha anyway. And it would be nice to see that more represented in the course material and in practice.
Monica, going back to your previous question answer, I'd like to ask if anyone... Could anyone here do something that is not creative?
I don't see it.
Well, is there a difference between being creative and seeing directly? I can take a crayon and make all kinds of figures, but am I seeing in the way that Monica was talking about? I see a fundamental difference between the two.
We can start with
your
words.
Well, you do
we construct our grids that we perceive through, and the trick of art is that you always see the world through these grids, and that's what Zen practice is about, is try to dissolve that grid of how you perceive. And the fun part about art is that you will have an experience where, you know, one of the woofs or the warps of that grid get twisted, and all of a sudden something pops out from that surface, and that's a experiential and visual experience that art gives you access to, and it's not really different than Zen meditation. And then the question of what's creativity is that it's really the perception, I think, more is the creative activity. So it could be that through brain science, there's just patterns of pleasures that run through your brain, and so it's an experience that happens in terms of firings inside your brain. So in a way, it sort of makes you wonder what really is going on. But there is your question about scribbling. It's really what you're perceiving is why you're doing the scribbling, I think, is where the creative act takes place, and how it breaks that grid.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that if you continue to scribble, there would be certain patterns that would emerge. And that as you continue to scribble, you refine your technique. I mean, whether consciously or unconsciously, just out of repetition, these things evolve. And I'm reminded of Franz Klein, who is on this page. and it's not hard to see that he was inspired by Japanese and Chinese calligraphy. But he said, you know, Zen monks learn calligraphy at the age of 5, and they do it their whole life. And so they have this, it's a refined sense of spontaneity. he said, I don't have that lifetime experience. So what he would do is he would lay out these sheets of paper and just go at it, you know, and then he would edit down to what, you know, he said, okay, this part is what I really, really matches my sense of what I want to express. And then he'd cut that out. So it's a way of looking, like you were saying, I think. And the other thing is that, you know, again, I mean, we're meaning-seeking creatures, and we can find meaning in anything. So it's more of a practice of of looking and engaging with what you're looking at, and no matter what it is, you can find something. Just because that's the way our brains work. We look at patterns and we try to create something out of them. So, I don't know.
I've been told that if you're a Zen priest, you're supposed to have an artistic outlet, whether it's calligraphy or sewing or playing an instrument. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you know about that?
Well, I just know that that's sort of that tradition, from what I understand, was put into place in Japan, and it just became really a part of Zen training that you had to choose one, or at least one. I don't know. Two? Yeah. And is that? Do you know if it's all Zen monks or if it's just Soto or? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I just think that was just a kind of an evolution of the influence of art in Zen from China to Japan. I don't know that much about the history or training practices in Japan, but maybe somebody else does. So. But I think it's kind of cool.
Thank you very much. When you talked about art being another opportunity for us to then flat, it reminded me of a walk I took in Falls Park across the river on the Mississippi, and some Zen practitioner or hippie or someone had taken driftwood and made this interesting abstract pattern on the beach. And then I started to see it in those things often when I look for it, and I hadn't seen them before until I saw them the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be, a shelf of rock and, little pebbles lined up for me to find.
And oh, that's wonderful.
And then I started leaving the room. Okay.
Yeah.
In unexpected places. So the teacher and the students and the encounter, I don't know how it relates to what you're talking about, but I believe I've experienced it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things, too, that a lot of these artists were trying to do is take things out of our normal context, put them in a gallery situation so that we really look at them. But the intent wasn't just to rarefy these objects. It was so that you would then go back into your life and see these things fresh. So it wasn't just to, make some sort of commercial statement. I mean, I'm sure there were some people who were doing that. But I think that there was this conscious intent to, it was that sort of merging of art and life, and to say, this is something you never look at. Look at this and look at how beautiful this can be out of context, and then see it in context with fresh eyes.
Hi, my name is Ray.
Hi.
First time here, so. When I was first learning Zen practice, my first teacher said that, because we also learned, we had to learn tea ceremony and kudu, part of our training, and our first thought was that we would just do something spontaneous. But he would say that spontaneity requires great preparation. So, and the idea was that the thing that you made, like a calligraphy, because it came out of, it was a direct expression of practice, it kept on being spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever looked at it felt spontaneous, so it could learn from that spontaneity. And so it was a constant teaching. So it wasn't just something you did and, like that. But the flip side of that was, you'd also say that, you should be able to turn a zendo into a dance hall.
Mm-hmm.
You should have that. You should be able to do that and not have it be anything more than that. And you should be able to not have it be upsetting or something. So you have to be able to... the idea is that a Zen monk should be able to do everything.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and not have it be something that disturbs practice but creates it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that you believe they try to teach us about our own practice.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And I think that idea of, I think that we, at least in the West, at least I did, you know, you grew up with this idea of spontaneity as just being kind of, you know, almost like a mindless regurgitation of something, you know, just, but I think that the way that it really, you know, from jazz to Japanese calligraphy to all these art forms, it's a way of preparing and preparing and preparing so that so it becomes part of you, and then it just comes out spontaneously. But it's what we do on the cushion so that we can go out and be in our lives and bring our practice to life.
I think that's the thing about creativity, as most people don't give it that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that if anybody here, every single, after you sat every day, that, you know, 10 minutes of art practice,
mm-hmm.
10 years or something, you'd be doing something wonderful,
mm-hmm.
and it would just be happening. But yeah, if you just get a crayon, it's not really, it's not, it doesn't have that commitment. It's just, it's probably got a lot of stuff. Got a lot of, you know, it's just art, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should try this. Mm-hmm. You kind of mentioned music. You talked about the process going into jazz, but music seems to be left out of the Zen aesthetic, you know, the Buddhist aesthetic. You might argue that something in music is made into mainstream, something like that, but. You know, I keep thinking of Katagiri's book, Return to Silence. You know, music is just kind of out of the loop.
Well, I think that I talked about the visual arts because that's what I know mostly. But I think that most of what I say can be... There's a thread that runs through a lot of all the arts. And I think that it can be applied to music as well. And, I mean, there is... What's the shakuhachi flute playing, which was also part of the Zen tradition. I do think that, well, I know of, just through my own exploration of jazz, I know that there's jazz musicians that were definitely influenced by the Dharma, and are now. And it's probably true if you looked. I'm just guessing. I haven't done the research that I have done on this. But, and just... I brought this book. This is a show that was just at the Guggenheim. I mean, this shows that this book is becoming accepted in the art world, because they just put on this show at the Guggenheim. It just ended in April, and it's called The Third Mind: American Artists Contemplate Asia. And in this, they go to performance and